All that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream. The supreme art of war is to subdue the enemy without fighting. Honesty is the first chapter in the book of wisdom. Everyone has a plan until they get hit. Do not pray for an easy life. Pray for the strength to endure a difficult one. Not all who wander are lost. If you cannot do great things, do small things in a great way. It is not what you look at that matters, it's what you see. Imagination was given to man to compensate him for what he is not. A sense of humor to console him for what he is. All things in moderation, including moderation. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In him was life, and that life is the light of men. The light that shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. The darkness could not comprehend it. Hi, this is Noel Goodman, and welcome to the Good Man Podcast.
Yo, what's up, Goody Mob? Welcome back to Planet Earth, home of Bitcoin and enchiladas and R&B music, and not particularly in that order, but if you had to describe the world to an alien, I guess you could do worse than to say, well, we've got imaginary money and good food and lots of cheese and passionate love songs about milkshakes. So yeah, you know pretty much all you need to know about us. But I've missed you guys, man. You know, I'm sorry that I've been gone for a bit. You know, I'm sort of getting ready for what I think is going to be an incredible year for all of us. And I'm anticipating a real boom in activity in the months to come. And when the time is right, I hope to be in the right position to take advantage of whatever opportunities come our way. Like they say, you know, success is when preparation meets opportunity. But unfortunately, that means spreading myself a bit thin sometimes. My priorities probably could be a bit better, but, you know, less HBO Max, more brass tacks. But I do love to chill, and maybe a little too much. And to be fair, I've always felt that you need a strong variety of things in your life in order to both focus on what you love and what you enjoy in order to create a greater diversity of perspectives for yourself. So speaking of perspectives and aliens, the topic of today's podcast, I sometimes wonder, you know, what sort of perspective an alien would come to if it arrived outside our planet's orbit and just sort of observed us for a time. You know, how would it describe our cultural differences, our religious institutions and moral assumptions and inclinations? You know, people are thinking and talking more about aliens now than perhaps ever. There's podcasts and news and television and programs and just a lot of books that are beginning to explore this new wave of what seems to be credible testimony, you know, coming out of sources that range from military reconnaissance footage and pilot statements and depositions and testimonials coming from normally sensible, trustworthy sources. I mean, the Navy had issued statements confirming several inside intel, and the Pentagon as well. Matter of fact, Congress has included within the stimulus bill this provision to fully disclose any gathered UFO intelligence, which is in and of itself kind of weird. And if anyone wanted to spend the day just sort of Googling evidence and military video footage, you could easily get lost in this deep well of information that just seems to go on forever. There's no shortage of information on mysterious footage and firsthand accounts and professional analysis on multiple sightings through many forms of technological surveillance. So with everything that's going on and that's available in the wide world of UFO research, it's still by and large shrouded in mystery and plausible deniability. What is available is compelling, but far from definitive. There is no smoking gun, if you will. No undeniable high-resolution video or photograph that can be authenticated. And something like that would undoubtedly go viral, you know, in today's HD world. There's just hundreds of millions of megapixel cell phones out there. And if aliens were indeed beginning to make serious inroads in communication, then we would expect to see a flood of inexplicable evidence, which we're not seeing as of yet. Not to say that what is out there isn't provocative, you know, video captured from Navy and Air Force jet fighters, merchant and naval ships, just a host of citizens all over the world, strange and enigmatic lights and ambiguous shapes passing over cities and planes, for lack of a better word, unidentified flying objects, UFOs. So what are they? And why is it that so many seemingly credible, trustworthy sources are beginning to suggest that perhaps we're getting ready to enter a new era of human understanding and experience, a new age, if you will, that leaves behind so much of what we thought we knew about ourselves and the cosmos in which we live, a new chapter in our development where the idea of a universe teeming with life not only seems possible, but probable, perhaps even necessary. Without a doubt, I mean, we currently live in a time of just fantastic ideas about our truest nature, who we are, and how we fit into the grand scheme of things, spirituality and science and philosophy, and all of these arguably separate domains of knowledge, they're converging and interesting in new ways. There's just a lot of ideas out there making space into our cultural conversation. Perhaps our entire universe is simply a simulation, you often hear, where we live out our lives in some advanced cosmic experiment beyond our comprehension. Perhaps we are nothing but a memory of a civilization long lost to existence and time. Perhaps we're created by yet another alien species, I mean, evolutionarily sped forward to claim our place in this pantheon of life amongst the stars. Maybe we're already dead. Simply reliving these moments of our existence over and over again, like some long-lost recording. And while a lot of these ideas might sound a bit crazy initially off the bat, they aren't without some thoughtful foundation and consideration. And even fragments of evidence that point us towards these ethereal directions that something strange and enigmatic and important is going on right now all around us. Things are not what they seem to be. And given what we do know and what we are now discovering, the ideas that shape the future are going to play a large part of where we find ourselves in 10, 20, or even 100 years, if we make it that far. The ideas that make up our worldview, you know, they're going to determine how we get there and the choices that we make and the beliefs that carry us through it. So are there aliens? I mean, before I give my own personal belief, I'll add that on the surface, by mostly all accounts, we should clearly believe that the universe is most likely teeming with life. How could it not? You know, there's billions of light years across trillions of planets and stars. It doesn't make sense that at least one or 1 million of these planets would not be filled with life, not unlike Earth. In fact, we have technology like the Kepler Space Telescope that we use to locate over 3,000 planets that are at least similar to Earth in size and location to its own sun. So how could they not have life? And if they do, how could we not see evidence of it? You know, perhaps radio waves or one of the many interstellar signals that intelligent life inevitably produces. But silence outside of the chaos of space is mainly silent. There's no indicators in the dark, no order that we can ascertain, no signals that we can decipher. So what could explain our continual gaze into the heavens with just no clue whatsoever whether or not the heavens ever gaze back on us? And some say it's because, well, aliens are far too advanced. And that makes sense, you know, perhaps because it seems unlikely that at least at one point in their development, there wouldn't be some sort of discernible trace. And we've become pretty good at scanning the stars for waves of electromagnetic energy, detectable anomalies, radiation, just any identifiable crumb of intelligence out there. But still, it's silence. And in reality, there are a lot of arguments back and forth over why this is so. In scientific culture, it's known as the Fermi paradox, which is named after the Italian-American physicist Enrico Fermi, which essentially states, why aren't we seeing any signs at all of extraterrestrial life? I mean, we should be, but we're not. Where are they at? And arguments that strive to solve this puzzle range from everything in between complete destruction of all advanced intelligent life within our purview, this idea that every civilization is ultimately doomed given large enough timelines, and fair enough, to complete evolutionary development of intelligent life to the point where they have become imperceptible to our limited means, like perhaps a micronized civilization. So there are a lot of ideas on why we aren't picking up on anything, but whatever answer you pick, the result is always the same: silence. And we often hear lots of reasons why aliens should certainly exist, but we curiously never hear why they shouldn't. And there are many people who have a specialty in this idea, even though most people generally have no real knowledge of the logical and scientific reasons why life certainly does not exist off of our lonely planet. There's just a substantial amount of work being done by small groups of mathematicians and scientists that attempt to prove that opposite view, that life is not only rare, but it's kind of impossible, and it really shouldn't exist to begin with. So let's look at that a little bit. And in Dr. Hugh Ross's book, Hugh Ross is an astrophysicist out of Canada. He has a great book called Why the Universe is the Way It Is, and he outlines a lot of rigid parameters that scientists are discovering and concerning the conditions for life as we know it. And physicists have long known that atoms and molecules and protein structures and DNA would not be possible without the sort of cosmological laws of physics that make up our universe. For example, the precise nature of nuclear forces, gravity, proton mass, and density make all of these things just remotely possible. But that's just the beginning. Once you get off the tip of the iceberg, you still need an ideal place to allow these things to take shape into something that looks like life. In order to have a planet that takes these immense probabilities and is even capable of creating the sort of order and precision that life requires is yet again another leap into this incredible world of biological abiogenesis, which is just a fancy way of saying the study of how life can arise from non-living organic matter. And it's daunting, I mean, to say the least. There are just a lot of prerequisites that everyday people have little understanding of. And if this does anything for you, it will at least give you a better appreciation for how unique and beautiful our Earth is, our home. For instance, what enables Earth to sustain life is due to just dozens and dozens of unique factors, including but not limited to our electric magnetic field, which is due to this ideal amount of iron in the Earth's core anymore, and it would block out too much of the sun's radiation. And we need that radiation. We need that energy so we can go to the beach and get tan. Too little magnetic field and the atmosphere is just ripped apart. Think Mars, just rock and sand, which Mars has a very, very little atmosphere. So we have just the right amount of iron in our core to allow the ideal amount of electromagnetic shielding. And there's dozens of these parameters. I mean, like a stable homeostatic planet, we need a very specific moon, for example, that keeps us on our axis just right. We need plate tectonics that are particularly set to allow the Earth to be stable. And of course, water-filled oceans is a prerequisite. You begin to read into these things and you understand that there's this ballet of oceanography and lunar synchronicity that allows us to enjoy the seasons that we have and the temperatures that we enjoy, and everything becomes vital. The distance that we are from the sun, the size of our planet, our storms, our hurricanes, our volcanoes, the North and the South Pole, even planets far away like Jupiter and Saturn, they all kind of do their part to protect Earth in space from enormous and dangerous structures like asteroids and other galactic remnants. So when you view the Earth from this lens and you see it as this rare blue jewel of the cosmos that it is, then the planet begins to look a lot less like a random object and more like life. You know, it lives and it breathes and it moves and beats like a heart in the quietest space, and everything in it and around it, it supports it, and by default supports us. And not just us, but every plant and microbe and cell inside it. I mean, we are truly a miracle living in this miraculous place inside of this miraculous universe. It's no wonder that some philosophers believe that this just seems to be too good to be true. Perhaps a simulation, a creative reproduction. There is a point where believing in pure chance to explain this becomes as blind as belief in anything at all. You know, one of my favorite quotes by Robert Jastrow is in his book, God and the Astronomers. He says, "For the scientist who has lived his life by faith in the power of reason, the story will end like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak, and he pulls himself over the final rock, and there he is greeted by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries." Now, those of you who know me or have listened to this podcast before, you probably have a good idea to what I centrally believe. But it's not as simple as you might think. I mean, it's no secret that I'm a Christian. But despite the odd belief which a lot of seculars hold, aliens do not contradict Christian belief, as far as I can see. I mean, there's a lot of people that seem to think if aliens were to arrive tomorrow, it would somehow shut down the church. But there's just no reason not to believe that God would and certainly could create life all throughout the universe. If I were confronted by an alien and had the opportunity for discussion, then those are the sort of questions that I would have. Their beliefs about life and death, truth and eternity. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised in the slightest if they had a character in their own history, much like our own Jesus of Nazareth, if not one and the same. But that's neither here nor there, because the point being, my faith is not shaken by the prospect of aliens. Far from it. And this isn't a discussion about spiritual reality, but in so much cosmic ones. And given the mathematical probabilities, I think it's safe to say that the odds of life appearing anywhere in our universe, for what I've been reading and seeing, it's astronomical. It's more like one in a quadrillion trillion. I mean, it's just a incomprehensibly stacked deck against life arising. And it makes sense. How could you get DNA from rock? How does that even happen? And you see people trying to cross that impossible divide with theories about, well, if you take lipids and water and lightning and it strikes at the right time and the amino acids form in just the right way, then, you know, you can perhaps get some sort of semblance of a primordial cell. And it's just when you look at that realistically, you start stacking miracles and improbabilities on top of improbabilities just to get to the first step. And this idea of life forming and beginning its journey towards self-reflection is far more daunting than people realize, much less reaching out to grasp on other worlds and having aliens visit perhaps us. Our universe is around 14 billion years old, and that sounds like a big number, and it is, subjectively. But given the kind of numbers and odds that we're talking about, when we talk about life arising, mathematicians like John Lennox, for example, who was one of the nicest guys I've ever had the pleasure of listening to, have said that it's just not rationally plausible. It doesn't add up. John Lennox, and unfortunately, the recently deceased John Polkinghorne, who were really instrumental in shaping my views on the universe, have long tried to shed light on the sort of misconceptions that we have about the universe and our place within it. And personally, for me, when I look on the stars and the immensity of the heavens above, I contemplate the power and the enormity of God and the grandeur of heaven. And that fills me with a sense of awe and security. I mean, it's why I'm here. And importantly, it's why the universe is here, in my estimation. But that doesn't answer the question why we started this podcast. What is happening? I mean, there's clearly something undeniable. And what are all these people seeing from every walk of life? We have to ask, what's going on? And I've got some ideas. I mean, some are pretty wacky. some are perhaps more reasonable. But let's go ahead and start off with the crazy ideas. And then we'll finish off with something progressively more sane as we near the end of the podcast. you just can't deny that people are witnessing UFOs. It's not just a group of fanatics. It's, you know, something is going on. And I do think it's important. I also think that it's going to intensify. Whatever it is transpiring among us, I don't see it diminishing, but or perhaps broadening. And when I first started thinking about this, I thought to myself, well, if I don't think it's alien life in the traditional sense, you know, from another planet, millions of light years away that's traveled here in order to observe us, then, which is the common refrain, then what is it? And I'll preface all this by saying that I'm pretty much a firm believer that modern men and women probably have at best a clumsy but reasonable view of what our world truly looks like. And I'm not willing to bet the farm on it, but in my heart, I give a lot of credence to established mainstream science, but you spend enough time with the likes of Graham Hancock or Richard Rudgley and similar other countercultural thinkers, and you begin to develop an appreciation for the cryptic and the unknown. I think it's important to understand that any ideas that are outside of mainstream science are almost always typically and many times rightfully belittled and ridiculed and dismissed, until sometimes they are eventually vindicated in some form. It's how we do things. And there's always been a lot of pressure in academia to hold on to what we know, or at the very least, what we think we know, and dismiss anything that disrupts the system. Ancient cultures and hidden civilizations and mysterious religions and lost wisdom. It puts us a bit outside of the realm of traditional education, and firmly in the realm of enigmatic discipline. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it is important to remember that if we truly do know a lot less about the world that we live in than we think we know, then we know even less about any probable unknown worlds that we can even imagine. So in that ominous spirit, we enter the fantastical world of speculation. It's more fun than fact, but we're talking about UFOs, so let's play. Whenever I'm having these sorts of conversations with friends, you know, it's kind of amazing where the imagination leads to. Talk of interdimensions and hidden planets and time travel. There's just no shortage of speculation about how to explain all the mysterious phenomena that continually seem to accumulate across the world. I used to be particularly attracted to the idea of time travel because it's easy to see how a human species from some far-off future could travel back in time to observe and perhaps use us, you know, their supposedly Homo sapien descendants in some necessary or helpful way. In almost every description of an alien by someone who purports to have seen them, they almost always look the same. Like the classic idea we have of aliens, you know, humanoid, big eyes, heads, thin, small bodies, grayish color. It's just not too far of a leap to speculate that aliens are in fact us in some evolutionarily far off future. Perhaps they need DNA or blood or something to do with reproduction. I mean, it's an interesting idea. But of course, all of these ideas exist in the world of conjecture. And as I let my imagination run wild, which is pretty much all we can do at this point, I begin remembering the work of Ignatius L. Donnelly, who was basically Graham Hancock before there was Graham Hancock. And for those of you who don't know Graham, he is he could be described as a British journalist who specializes in ancient myths and lost civilizations. His critics would say that he's a conspiratorial pseudoscientist, and his followers would say that he's often more right than wrong. I would probably fall somewhere in the middle of these two. I've never been afraid, though, to at least entertain some of the, you know, the more idiosyncratic ideas. And at the very least, they can point us in a direction that we normally would not consider. That's, I think, ultimately the greatest gift that our culture's contrarian thinkers can give us, their ability to break free of currents of uniformity in thought. But the danger of that being that if you break away too far from the river, well, you end up in the mud. So there's a certain amount of discernment you have to have when you're considering some of the wilder ideas out there. But Ignatius Donnelly, who lived up until the early 1900s, was convinced that Plato's writings of Atlantis, by which all accounts seems as if Plato is indeed talking about something that exists and not simply some figment of his philosophical imagination, was actually telling an accurate historical telling of ancient civilized nation. I mean, Donnelly writes in his book, Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, that not only was Atlantis a real world advanced civilization, but that it was responsible for much of the ancient wisdom and technology and religion that continued on in some form or other after the island succumbed to natural disaster. Now, I've got no idea whether or not ancient civilized nations existed before our recorded histories documented it, but I've spent enough time with these ideas to know that there's more to it than we give credit. And as someone who tries to hold himself to at least a certain level of rationalism, I'm still not willing to dismiss these type of startling ideas out of hand. I think there's a remarkable audacity within mainstream intelligentsia that avoids engaging in controvertible ideas because on the surface, they seem far too absurd to be taken seriously. But we do so at the risk of missing some of nature's greatest and grandest riddles. So I got to thinking about ideas that I had never considered before. And like, what if intelligence and life on Earth was not only adapted to live on the surface of the planet, but somehow within unknown places inside the Earth? And what is more unknown than the watery depths of our oceans where Atlantis supposedly sank? Or better yet, below that, deep within the confines of our planet. I mean, how far does it go? How deep can life reach? And even though I've played around with this idea for some time, I was delighted to see that the theory of hollow Earth popped up in last week's movie, Godzilla vs. Kong. Now, I'm not going to go that far, but a lot of people don't realize, you know, just how deep our Earth actually goes. So I looked it up. The oceans on average are about 2 miles deep. Not as deep as you might think, but the deepest trenches down below do manage to cut about as deep as 7 miles down. For reference, it takes about 60 miles to get into space from where you're at right now. 60 miles up or 3 miles down is about as far as anyone has gone outside of a very select few submersibles and robots. So how much Earth is there between where we live and the hot molten core at the center? It's about 2,000 miles down, and that's just an incredible amount of Earth beneath us. You know, I've heard it described before that if Earth were a bowling ball, then all we know of it exists only on the paint of the surface. Our deepest mine is like 2 miles. So it's not too hard to imagine that there might be life somewhere down there, deep in the depths of the caverns below, and you know, imaginably, there could be caves that reach up hundreds of miles to the top and thousands of miles across that we conceivably would have little to no knowledge of. We know more about the heavens above than the ground in which we walk. So what if that's why these so-called aliens look so much like us? Perhaps their thick, gray-skinned bodies are not adapted to the radiation and sun exposure that we're so accustomed to. Maybe they rise from the sea in their own advanced technology and study their surface-dwelling evolutionary cousins. It sounds crazy, but considering the odds of life evolving somewhere else, it's probably mathematically more sound that wildly alternative life continued to evolve here than any other plausible alternative. Maybe Atlantis was real. I mean, whoever those people might have been have long retreated to where we could never reach, far, far below. And until the inevitable day when we finally come face to face with another humanoid species that evolved on our planet alongside us, perhaps even before us. I mean, there's just no shortage of fantastic theories about what UFOs are or what aliens might be. But my favorite ones have always resonated with the idea that the answer is something far closer to home than the stars. Though I admit the stars are far more romantic and for many a lot less frightening than the idea of mole men being down there digging through the earth or interdimensional scavengers or spiritual beings who may or may not be malevolent. if there truly is a spiritual realm beyond our ideas of matter, space, time, and energy, then perhaps UFOs exist in that space. But what if the truth were not so fantastic? I mean, what if all this mystery was actually something far more ordinary? When I was in the U.S. Navy, I remember the first time I saw the high-speed vessel Swift, or HSV 2 Swift, in Norfolk, Virginia. And I thought, holy crap, what the hell is that? That's the coolest ship I ever saw. And not only is this thing super fast and big, it has this really, really cool design and just looks nothing like I thought a Navy ship was supposed to look like. And during my time in service, you know, I saw a lot of cool technology and aircraft, you know, submarines. I was a sonar tech on board the USS Thorne and then later the USS Gonzales. And I remember performing mock battle drills with the Israelis off of Haifa. And I was, you know, never not amazed at how advanced their tech was. And it was early on that I realized that there are levels to what we know about military capability. You know, there's the typical civilian knowledge, and then the enlistee like myself, even though I did have some secret clearances. And there were people well over me, of course, and then people well over them. So it goes farther than that. And because within even our own military, there are hierarchies of specialized knowledge and programs. An Air Force pilot might not recognize that the shape in front of him that's flying impossibly fast and unusual is in fact an advanced concept drone, green-lighted by the Pentagon and flown by remote out of Washington. And what we perceive to be otherworldly tech might just be our most advanced technology at play, something that the civilian world may not even see for another 20, 30 years, which by then our military applications will be just on a whole nother level. So that's a possibility, to be sure. Disappointing, but far more conceivable to consider that strange UFOs are advanced American drone technology, or perhaps, you know, Israeli technology, which is truly leading in the world, able to do things perhaps that F-15s cannot. But there's a fundamental problem to this theory, because in a lot of the recorded footage by our military, the UFOs are moving not only in strange formations, but in theoretically impossible ones. There's like a immediate stops, unimaginable acceleration, absurd abilities and movements, physically impossible is the description you often hear. You can't have an object in the air racing hundreds of miles across the sky, stop on a dime, turn in the opposite direction, swoop low, and then descend only to climb again, and then vanish. Drone or not, that's just not something that aircraft are capable of. So we're left where we started, you know, mystery and enigma. And we know that something is there, but nothing quite explains it. And we're just left with a lot of interesting thought. But unfortunately, we're left in the dark, fumbling about, making sense of riddles and fantasies, both hopeful and fearful that the answer will give us some insight into ourselves and our purpose in this world. And ultimately, is that not why the idea of aliens enchants us the way it does? It promises to reveal so much about ourselves. Time and time again, the fundamental questions and worldviews take center. Who are we? Why are we here? Where are we going? And how do we get there? And for many, that's what the indisputable discovery of alien life would mean. Like I said earlier, it's no secret that I'm a man of faith. And people often ask me, well, if aliens reveal themselves to the world, would that disrupt my faith? And how would that impact my Christianity? And the answer is, of course, well, not at all. I mean, there's just nothing contradictory about the possibility of life throughout the universe, even technologically advanced life, within the connection and the bridge towards divinity and transcendence that my Jesus offers. There's just no contradiction between the gospel and UFOs. Indeed, if I had the opportunity to speak to an alien from some far off solar system, I'd relish the opportunity to ask questions like, well, did you have an agreed concept that governed your ideas on material existence, impossible metaphysical ethereal being? You know, were you burdened with the same longings of the heart that mankind yearns so desperately to satisfy? Blaise Pascal said that there's a God-shaped hole in the heart of every man. And C.S. Lewis took it a step further when he said, and I'm paraphrasing, that every desire you have in your heart is filled by something that's readily available in the world, which we evolved to hunger for. You know, you hunger for food, well, because there's food. You long for companionship because we evolved in these groups. You seek out beauty. Well, the world is rich in exotic and rare splendor. But there's something else that you desperately need that the world cannot provide. Deep within every one of us, there's this insatiable thirst that cries out for sublimity, transcendence, unconditional love and virtue and truth and meaning and purpose, eternity. And as much as we try to fill that hole with the accoutrements of the world, we'll continually come to this frustrating dead end. Nothing quite fills it. And this frustration can reveal to us perhaps a truly fantastic and foundational truth that we're not made for this world entirely, or something more. We are different. And dare I say it, we are special and unique and valuable. And perhaps that's what we hope to find in these tales of interdimensions and simulations and extraterrestrials, the promise of the phenomenal and incredible, the outstanding thrill of a life that breaks free of the monotonous routines that grind away at us every day. And yet we have that. Even now, and we don't need far-off galaxies or hidden civilizations to expose us to this extraordinary wonder of life, you know, this adventure that we crave, this dignity that we ache for, and we have this tremendous calling in our life, and it's there, and we'll spend the rest of our lives in fear and trembling working that out, because it's not only important, it's perhaps the most important. And I don't know what's going to be unveiled in the months or the years to come, what sort of revelations we'll uncover about aliens or about ourselves. But I do believe that we are standing at the edge of a great change in this world, and there'll be victories and failures and turmoil and festivity. But no matter what we learn, either here on earth or in the heavens above, in the body or in the spirit, we don't have to be swayed back and forth, to and fro by every shove of this culture, of this world, because we are firm in our own resolve and purpose and faith. We are pillars of salt, and it's going to take a lot more than uncertainty and fear of little green men to ever change that. So I'll go ahead and wrap it up with that, man. I just want to thank you guys for listening to another episode of the Good Man Podcast. I promise I won't wait so long until the next episode. But God bless you. I love you. I'll see you soon. Peace.